from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Illinois' governor is trying to take over a Chicago school system in fiscal crisis. In Detroit, teachers are staging sick outs in a school system that has already been taken over by the state. And Supreme Court justices are now deciding a case that could deal a major blow to teachers' unions. This hour, On Point, urban education problems going critical in Chicago and Detroit, and lessons for the whole country. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Where are your sympathies here with the teachers, the cities, the states, the kids? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will go to a moment to Chicago and Detroit. Emotions running very high in both places. More sick out yesterday in Detroit. Here's a parent whose children have been hit by the Detroit Public Schools sick outs day after day without school.
Governor, please speak up and do something about DPS school. Our kids need a safe environment, and they need to be in school every day.
They need to be in school. Here's 17-year-old Detroit student Marketh Jones in December supporting teachers participating in the sick outs.
The students of Detroit, we are ready to stand in solidarity with the teachers who are taking action, and we will support our teachers all the way. And, like, I just want to say that we are a force to be reckoned with when the teachers and the students of Detroit unite.
Yeah. And from Chicago, Chicago Public School teachers, well, whose schools are they? They'll tell you.
Schools!
Our
schools!
Our schools!
Our schools!
The governor of Illinois, not so sure. They've got problems. Joining me first today from Washington is Maggie Severns, education reporter for Politico. Maggie, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The facts of the case. Let's start with Chicago. What's the problem?
So in Chicago, we have a problem that's actually been years and years in the making, which is that this is a city that during the 1990s, when Daley was mayor, they actually stopped contributing to their pension fund, and they really went for this growth strategy in the schools. You know, so there were pay raises for teachers. They opened a lot of charter schools. And then, like happened all across the country, starting around 2009, we had the recession hit. And now, you know, declining pension returns, and there have been some students who left the district, and all of it kind of amounts to Chicago schools being really, really deep in debt.
They've got underfunded teachers' pensions and something like, I read, $500 million operating deficit this year.
Yeah, and the deficit is tied to the pension payments. Mm-hmm. So they need to be paying back into the pension fund. And you also have things like now they have all these charter schools, and there are also a lot of neighborhood schools that haven't been closed. So there are too many schools and not enough students, which amounts to big, big operating costs that are, you know, unnecessary in a lot of ways. But on the other hand, you know, Chicago's tried to close some schools, and people don't like seeing schools closed, and people don't like, you know, seeing the number of options for their kids shrink. And the end of the day, it's problem upon problem. And, you know, people aren't sure that the schools will necessarily even be able to finish the school year this year. There's that much of a financial emergency happening.
It's been a huge headache for Mayor Rahm Emanuel. The Illinois governor wants to take over these schools. Why would he want to do that?
Yeah. And, you know, I think that when you look at the governor level, you're seeing some of this is education policy and some of it is politics, right? So Illinois Governor Rauner would like to take over the Chicago schools, which could hypothetically give him power to cancel the union contract and renegotiate it himself. And Rauner has been, you know, he was someone who was elected on kind of a Scott Walker-esque, you know, platform that includes some union busting, among other policies that he's had problems getting through in the state house. So Rauner, I think, would like to see financial, you know, improvements in Chicago schools, but he also would like the power to renegotiate that teachers union contract and perhaps, you know, go after some workers' rights issues in the city.
Illinois or Chicago wants Illinois, the state, to pick up those pension obligations. Of course, Illinois statewide has a huge unfunded pension mandate problems already. Let's go to Detroit. The state's already taken over there, and we've had these sick outs with teachers saying our actual buildings are falling apart at this point. Is that the core reason? Their feet are falling through holes in the floor. Is that why they're sicked out?
Yeah, you know, that's one. I think that's a very visible problem and one that's very easy for teachers to point to. But in Detroit, you've also have these really long-standing financial issues. You know, the schools have been underfunded for years. Students have been leaving the city. Like Chicago, there's been more school choice. So you wind up with both neighborhood schools and charter schools, and some of the neighborhood schools don't have enough students in them. So it's a lot of these, you know, some similar financial problems that you're seeing in Chicago and Detroit and other places across the country. But in Detroit, it's undeniably worse than almost anywhere else. And so I think that teachers are protesting both, you know, they're talking about these building conditions, but there also are a lot of issues with just funding for the schools overall and with the emergency management that the schools have been under. So Detroit schools have actually been under state control in recent years. And a lot of people think that Governor Snyder and, you know, the other managers involved just haven't been doing enough to try and turn the schools around.
I've got to go to Detroit in just a second here to one of the teachers who's been in those sick-outs, but very briefly, the Supreme Court now in the middle of this with a case it has taken up that could well take away a lot of power / money from teachers' unions.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting moment for unions from the national standpoint. You have the 2016 elections, I think, are going to be consequential for them. And you have this case, Friedrichs case, which is actually teachers in California that had filed it. And what they're alleging is that compulsory union dues are violating their free speech rights. So those are the union dues that someone can be have to pay out of their paycheck as opposed to elect to pay to be part of the union. And what they're arguing is that basically all union activity is inherently political and they shouldn't have to pay these dues. Now, practically what would happen if the Supreme Court sides with the plaintiffs in the Friedrichs case, which it sounded like they were going to based on the oral arguments recently, is that it would be a huge blow to teachers' unions' just income. I mean, they wouldn't be taking in all this money that they're taking from teachers across the country, which would make it really a lot more difficult for unions to kind of stay powerful as we know them. They've already been facing declining membership in recent years. And so they're already at this kind of perilous moment where it's hard to, you know, kind of stay powerful, which requires money. And the Friedrichs case could much further diminish that.
Maggie Severance has been on top of all this for Politico. Maggie, we're very grateful to you for being with us for a minute today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
With us now from Detroit, Nicole Conaway. She has helped organize the sick outs in Detroit, is a high school math teacher at East English Village Preparatory Academy in Detroit. She was in court yesterday when Michigan Court Appeals Judge Cynthia Stevens denied a request for a restraining order against teachers who have been part of the sick outs. Nicole Conaway, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
As a Detroit teacher, why have you joined the sick out movement?
Well, as a teacher and also an organizer with the civil rights organization, the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action and Integration and Immigrant Rights and Fight for Equality by Any Means Necessary, which is the driving and leading force behind this action that's provided the political perspective that we're fighting on, this is the time to stand up and fight for our students and our schools. And I'm so proud of the teachers and the students' action. Many students walked out of schools yesterday. Some were disciplined, suspended, and we're fighting to defend them because, like the judge said yesterday in denying the injunction, this is political free speech, and this is way beyond a labor dispute. This is a political movement with the goal of restoring democracy to the people of Detroit, because the root of the problem is the emergency management scheme, which is a racist state program of the governor to privatize our public schools, our public water, and more for profit, with disastrous results like we've seen in Flint with the lead poisoning and decaying, overcrowded, under-resourced schools in Detroit. And the people of Detroit, the teachers and students, have said enough is enough. This is the time to fight. And together, you know, we're going to grow this movement and get bigger and keep asking until we win and get democracy back in Detroit with an elected school board that's accountable to the people of Detroit that we can negotiate with to get the conditions we need in our school. We also need the state-incurred debt forgiven so that we have solvency. The governor's plan to dissolve the district or create an old, cold new co is completely unacceptable, and we won't accept that, and that has to stop.
But didn't the state come in the first place because the finances of Detroit public schools were in such a terrible mess?
Actually, before 2009, there was a surplus. We had money. We had increasing enrollment. We had small but steadily increasing test scores. And from the beginning, I believe it was a scheme to take away the not only finances and resources, but political power from Detroit. Everybody in Detroit understands that it was never about coming in to fix our schools. They created a special law that only applied to Detroit because I think it was only for districts over 100,000 students. And And everybody in Detroit understands that, and that's why we're all fighting so hard right now.
You know, there are skeptics out there who will say, oh boy, here we go. Teachers unions, they just demanded and demanded. They got big contracts that the city couldn't afford. The unions put the city in this situation in the first place. What do you say to that perspective? You know it's out there.
Well, it's totally wrong. You know, unions are what created the middle class in this country. Before that, everybody was working poor. We do not have, you know, exorbitant pay and benefits. I think we did have you know, pretty standard basic income and benefits that every American deserves. And we've seen decrease after decrease, 10% pay cut, increase in our health care, so much that, you know, some teachers are on assistance. Some teachers are taking their children to free clinics because they can't afford health care. We cannot have a city without a thriving, you know, a thriving city, without a strong public school system.
How do you think this is going to be resolved? How do you think this will work out?
The emergency manager's got to go. I think this will be resolved when we have the end of emergency management, which the state board of education treasurer just called for yesterday as well. So our support is growing, and we have democracy returned to the people of Detroit, and we can elect leaders that we can hold accountable.
Who's going to pay the debt? The debt's real.
The state needs to forgive that debt. They just found a surplus. The money is there. They could be, you know, actually charging the businesses downtown taxes instead of giving them abatements that go on for years and years. They can return the money that was voted on by the people of Detroit to go to the schools and then turned around to Ms. Phillips build a new stadium for hockey team.
Nicole, you're breaking up on us, but I'm sure we got the heart of your message, and I appreciate you sharing it with us today from Detroit, Nicole Conaway, who has helped organize the Sick Outs in Chicago, high school math teacher in Detroit. A lot more on the table here than broken windows and leaky plumbing. She's talking about fundamental justice and equity, about democracy, she says. We're looking at urban education problems reaching what can look like a meltdown point in Chicago, in Detroit. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about urban education problems reaching a meltdown point in Detroit and Chicago. Budgets in shambles, teachers defiant, the kids in trouble, things kind of coming apart. And looking over it all, a Supreme Court decision coming on public workers' unions, teachers' unions, that could be very, very consequential. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Are you with the Detroit teachers going to sick out over schools that are falling apart and more? Or should they hang in there no matter what? Are you with the Illinois governor pushing to take over Chicago's schools with their $500 million deficit just for this year's operations? Here's former Detroit Federation of Teachers President Stephen Kahn explaining to ABC's WXYZ the reasons he called for a citywide strike.
Class size, it's gone up, up, up. The pay that's been destroyed, so teachers, the district cannot attract teachers. The classroom conditions, we've got people who will testify point by point about the terrible nature of our schools given the emergency management that was designed supposedly to help, but in fact has been designed to destroy public education.
And in Chicago, a group opposing budget cuts for the Chicago public system, school system, put together this video featuring students from Chicago public schools.
Even with 20, 25 students, sometimes there's so many questions, you don't get through the entire lesson. I could only imagine 40 people.
By saying we will lose 20 teachers, that's terrifying.
Students are being robbed of their opportunity to fulfill their potential. Don't they deserve the same chance to succeed as the rest of the students in Illinois? Why is this happening to Chicago public school students?
Most of us are students of color.
Most of us are low income. Are we really equal?
Are we really equal? Raising fundamental questions here. At the same time, politicians fight over responsibility for fiscal troubles and more. Here's Republican Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner at a press conference last week, opposing here a deal by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. He's been working on it with the teachers union, which would cut costs while avoiding mid-year layoffs.
We can take on the teachers union in Chicago. The mayor is afraid of them. He's not taking them on. He caved in the teacher strike 4.5 years ago, and he's sending the message right now. He's going to give them what they want and then say, state, pay for it.
Real troubles. Joining me now from Chicago is Elizabeth Todd Breland, professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Her forthcoming book is A Political Education, Black Politics and Education Reform in Post-Civil Rights Chicago. Elizabeth Todd Breland, thank you very much for being here today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Washington is Andrew Rotherham, co-founder, partner at Bellwether Education Partners, nonprofit there supporting education reform. We'll ask what that means exactly. He's also executive editor of Real Clear Education, part of the Real Clear Politics family of news websites, contributing editor to U.S. News and World Report. Andrew Rotherham, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Andrew, Elizabeth, I'll come right to you there in Chicago. Andrew, step back for a second. Do these two sort of crisis moments in Chicago and Detroit belong in one discussion? Is this part of one problem, and what is it, Andrew?
Well, they belong in one discussion in the sense that you've got two school districts, sort of legacy Rust Belt cities, important cities in the country that are experiencing change. In Detroit, you've got just a really dramatic drop in student enrollment. Some of that is students going to charter schools. Some of that students leaving the system. But over the last decade, you've lost about 100,000 students. That's created sort of a huge set of budget constraints. In Chicago, as Maggie said during your setup, the pension issue is a big piece of this, and a deal that was cut back during the Daley administration in the mid-90s, which at the time was a great deal for the Chicago schools, has now, as time has passed, turned out to not be a particularly good deal. So there's a huge pension overhang there fiscally. And then you add on top of that, they've had some declining enrollment. The district last year fell under 400,000 students for the first time in decades. And so they are shrinking. Charters have a footprint there. It's a lot smaller than in Detroit. Only about 14% of Chicago kids are in charters. But that's adding to this. And so you've got sort of two sort of distinct problems, the retirement problem and so forth. And so the specifics vary. But the sort of in terms of this idea of you've got these school districts that are now the footprint of the districts is too large. There has to be some closing of schools and some personnel changes and so forth. They have those things in common. The specifics that are driving it are a little bit different in both places.
Elizabeth Todd Breland, there are big issues here. But is this in some way about job security when they are cutting back? If indeed the footprint is too large and cuts need to come, is this about teachers protecting turf or something else?
I think we see two things happening at the same time. On the one hand, you do see these, we'll say, financial crises. But I'd like to stress that these are really manufactured and produced. So that currently in Chicago and in Illinois, one thing you see is you see Democrats and Republicans coming together. So particularly in the form of Mayor Rahm Emanuel and Bruce Rauner, although now they're being framed as adversaries, they both are very much in favor of very similar policies as far as privatizing public education and attacking the teachers' union. And the state budget issues right now that we have, we don't have a budget. And the reason that we don't have a budget
in
is because the governor is holding hostage the budget, not over actual budget issues, but over union-busting policies that he wants to push through. So I think that's happening on the one hand. On the other hand, you do see teachers, I think, both in Chicago and Detroit, fighting very vigorously for improved teaching and learning conditions for their students. And in Chicago, this is certainly a particular form of what we call social movement unionism, where the union is not just talking about wages and benefits, but also very much talking about the issues facing communities. In Chicago, the Chicago Teachers Union has created connections with a number of Black and Latino communities in the city or community organizations, and also activists in the Black Lives Matter movement, such that, sort of echoing some of the things that Nicole was saying earlier, this push for a representative school board is something that's happening both in Detroit and in Chicago. And this fundamental issue of Black and Latino communities in particular, because both of these school systems are almost 90% Black or Black and Latino, people demanding their rights to be represented.
We've got a Detroit teacher here at protest last week. We don't have her name, but she's talking to this issue of a changing approach to education. Maybe you're suggesting this is what Governor Rauner and Mayor Emanuel want in Chicago. I'm not sure how they'd respond to that. But here's a Detroit teacher saying this is all about privatizing and ultimately shareholder returns, not education.
We have started to move as a nation from the business of education into the education business. You see, it used to be my job to just educate you. And then somebody on the sidelines decided, well, you know what, I can do that better for less, but still take all that money. But it's like your allegiance is not to these students to make sure they get an education. Your allegiance to your shareholders and to your investors.
Is this about privatizing, Andrew Rotherham, or is this about looking for something to get better outcomes? I mean, I'm looking at a Detroit News headline here. Just last fall, Detroit worst in math and reading scores among big cities. Worst, bottom of the pile.
Yeah, I mean, look, the scores in both these cities have challenges, and Chicago, despite sometimes being heralded as an improving success story in urban education, there's a lot of challenges there. Detroit is simply atrocious, and I was very surprised to hear this idea that somehow they were doing well back in 2009, the year that your earlier guest cited that they were doing well. Yeah, 7% of eighth graders were proficient in reading, 4% were proficient in math.
7%, 4%. Yeah, that's shocking.
That's on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is basically a good measure about whether you're ready to go on to some kind of post-secondary like college. So, I mean, this is a system that's just been underserving kids for a very long time, and it's tragic. I mean, look, privatization, I mean, to me, like, what we ought to be talking about here is how do you get kids into good seats? And privatization and what that looks like, that immediately gets into all these adult politics that swirl around this. I'm very skeptical of dual bottom line, the teacher you just quoted. You know, I do think there's it's difficult to serve two masters, and if you have to deliver a profit and you have to deliver results, that's challenging.
Explain what you mean dual bottom line, talking about shareholder returns. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, look,
outcomes, educational outcomes, and how's the profit?
Exactly. I'm not saying it can't be done. And here's the irony of this conversation. Actually, in Detroit, the for-profit schools that are operating there actually do very well on average. Not all of them, but on average, it's actually a strong. So if I were looking to make that argument, Detroit's not the place I'd go. There's other cities and states. I'd go to Ohio. I'd go to Arizona, Texas, Florida. To make that case. In Detroit, it's actually played out better than I think people thought. But the fact is, most of these schools, and particularly the ones we're talking about in Chicago, are nonprofit. Reasonable people can disagree about education governance and what it ought to look like. But I feel like as soon as we get into these conversations where it's privatization, it's about destroying the public schools, it detracts from what needs to be a pretty serious conversation about some really hard choices of what do we do to get both of these school systems back on their feet. I mean, the numbers we're talking about in terms of the fiscal numbers are just extraordinary when people say, well, the state should forgive the debt. I mean, okay, like, and everybody should get a pony too. I mean, these are just not serious solutions. There's got to have to be some give all around. And I think Elizabeth's exactly right. I mean, the politics in Illinois, there's some offers and some deals on the table to help try to relieve the pressure on Chicago, but those seem to be going nowhere unless they get attached to a whole set of politics coming out of Springfield around labor policy. And so, you know, and then on the other side, you've got politics within the unions. Like you had, you were quoting Mr. Kahn earlier, who, you know, was forced out as head of the Detroit Federation of Teachers. You know, there's a huge battle going on around that. And so while everybody talks about, you know, like, you know, the union and management and their negotiations, on the other side of the union, you've got a bunch of people who think the union's selling them out and are hammering them politically from the other side. So the politics that swirl around this are just enormous and make it really hard to get past this rhetoric and get down to what does it actually look like to restructure these systems fiscally in a sustainable way going forward.
We've got callers from Detroit and around the country. I want to get to them. But if I may, Elizabeth, first to you on this issue of equity, of justice. I mean, people are tying this all the way to the Black Lives Matter movement, and our minds have been opened to this line of critique recently. But on the same time, I'm looking at the numbers here, and City of Chicago per capita spending on students versus the whole state of Illinois. Instructional spending, $9,700 per student in Chicago, $74 statewide. More in Chicago. Operational spending total, $15,000 in Chicago, $12,500 statewide. More in Chicago. What do those numbers say about an equity problem?
I actually think that if we look at the state as a whole, and we're thinking about equity, Chicago pays more than its fair share. And that's part of the issue in the pension question that was brought up earlier. Right now, the city of Chicago pays for pensions or pays into pensions for teachers across the state, but they don't pay into the pensions for teachers in the city of Chicago.
Because the state guarantees teachers' pensions statewide except for Chicago.
Correct.
There's two separate pension systems in Chicago.
Yeah, got it. But what about the per student spending, Elizabeth? It's higher in Chicago substantially.
No, I hear what you're saying. I think that's perhaps compared to the whole state, but certainly not compared to our predominantly white, more affluent suburbs who have far more per pupil spending. And I think we also see the need is greater in the city, and we're not meeting the needs of the students that we have. Just to get to your other point real quickly about teachers. I think this sort of brings us back to the court case in some ways, because this is a concerted effort. I just want us to be clear that this isn't some sort of anomalous thing, but that what's happening with the Supreme Court and the Center for Individual Rights, who sponsored the case, these are the same funders that are funding who funded, quite honestly, Rahm Emanuel, who funded Bruce Rauner. And so I
Illinois
think that
governor, what, to take away revenues from public unions, including teachers unions.
Exactly. And so what we see at the Supreme Court level is an increasingly increasingly powerful and empowering corporations while trying to strip power away from one of the few spaces where working class people actually have an opportunity to organize and have a voice, which is in unions. But I think if we take away, again, I think that it's actually very important to think about what are some alternatives in terms of the spending issue. And there are many alternatives. It's just about the political will to do so. In Chicago, we have tax increment financing funds that could be used for the schools. We have banks who in other places and municipalities have been sued for these shady swap rates, but our mayor refuses to do this. We could tax on financial transactions. There are so many different options, but there's not the political will right now to do so. And I think fundamentally that's an issue of justice. It's an issue of racial justice, and it's an issue of economic justice. And so it's not by accident that these are the communities who are suffering the most from these issues.
Find the resources for the cities. I'm looking here at a quote out of Detroit saying, what we are seeing is basically the rationing of high-quality education, not only in Detroit but in all cities. Maybe so. Nick in Detroit, Michigan. Thank you for calling, Nick. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Just to give you a little more nuance to the situation here in Detroit.
Yes.
I don't know if you're aware or not, but the emergency manager that's been put over the Detroit Public Schools is the same emergency manager who was in charge of Flint when they decided to go off the Detroit city water supply and go onto the Detroit River.
I did read that over the weekend. What does that tell you, Nick?
Well, that told me that obviously he makes bad decisions. And then in addition to that, our local ABC affiliate here, WXYZ, is doing an expose on him right now, where they've discovered that he's earning like $225,000 a year, and the people that he's hiring around him, he's giving benefits such as 3 weeks paid vacation plus 2 weeks sick time plus huge salaries. This is all in a school district that can't even afford to heat their buildings, that has some teachers making as little as $10 an hour. It's crazy.
Nick, I appreciate your call. Andrew Rotherham, how about it? The state oversight is supposed to bring accountability, but you hear our caller saying, no, it's not accountability. It's the opposite. Same manager as over the Flint water crisis. Not very heartening.
Well, I think, it points up two things. One, in both these cities, you have external factors that have eroded trust. I mean, the situation in Flint is atrocious, and as more details come out, more so, and that weakens trust, obviously, in the state. And in Chicago, you have the situation with the police shooting that's eroded a lot of trust and support for the mayor. And so you get all these sort of various kinds of adult politics swirling around this. I mean, so the fact is, state oversight has become a popular way to deal with these things. It's a totally mixed bag. You can actually find some examples where it's been successful. You can find plenty of examples where it hasn't been successful. What it does is it can sort of remove some of the politics, and you can start to have a different lens on things. But it, of course, then introduces a different set of politics, which is the state politics. And agendas there. So it's certainly it's one of these things we do in education where you try to figure out how can you create structural ways to get around what are essentially human problems, and that rarely works. The issue becomes fundamentally in both these places, and there's a proposal, of course, now in Illinois for state takeover. Like, the math is the math, and just taking over, the pension problem that Elizabeth talked about, and the way that Chicago is essentially double paying, that's a very, she's exactly right. It's a real problem. That problem does not go away with state oversight. The huge deficits that they are running in Detroit and the growing debt, which is estimated to be over $515 million by this summer, that doesn't go away with state takeover either. So there's no substitute for everybody laying down their arms and coming together and figuring out how do you restructure these systems in a way that's sustainable. And as long as you have sort of all these various agendas on all sides going back and forth, that's awfully hard to do.
It sounded much more nose to nose in recent weeks, not laying down of arms, just 20 seconds before the break, Elizabeth. But what's the outcome that the states are pushing for here? Do you agree they're looking for privatization as a way to get out from under the fiscal responsibility for these schools?
Oh, yes, I do. I think that particularly what we're seeing here in Illinois is the governor's proposal being put forth is about that very thing. But I am very encouraged, actually, by seeing teachers and students and communities, Black and Latino communities, coming together to fight back against this. And I think that's where progress is made.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking today about urban education problems reaching really a kind of meltdown point in Detroit and Chicago, budgets in shambles, teachers defiant, kids in trouble, things kind of coming apart and looming over it all, a Supreme Court decision coming on public workers' unions, teachers' unions, with Elizabeth Todd Breland, professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Her forthcoming book is A Political Education, and it's all about politics and education reform in post-civil rights Chicago. Andrew Rotherham joins us from Washington and Bellwether Education Partners there, watching the whole situation nationally. You can join us. What do you think? Do we have a management problem here, a union problem, and fundamental equity problem in the way we resource urban schools? How do you read what's going on in Chicago, in Detroit, and beyond? Lots of response online. Fiscally Responsible writes to us on our website, onpointradio.org, says teachers who participate in sick-outs should not be paid, but docked for the pay, plus a penalty. Another example of the unions holding a gun to the head of the public and threatening to pull the trigger. But Shotzi writes to us, Governor Snyder, that's in Michigan, of course, should be criminally charged for what he's done to Michigan. Fight on teachers, students, and citizens. Here is Michigan's governor on MSNBC last week. You've heard him talking a lot about Flint water lately, but also talking about the big problems in Detroit's public schools.
So last year I proposed a plan, and I'm still working on getting implemented, to essentially make a $700 million investment to deal with the historic debt of Detroit public schools, also give them resources to make a transition and do some investments. And the issue there is I need legislative support, and I've asked the legislature to do that, and I want to get that done before we have court intervention in the situation.
Elizabeth Todd Breland, what's the problem? He wants to make an investment in Detroit public schools, a big one, $700 million.
I mean, I think it gets back to what Nicole was talking about earlier in terms of this idea of a representative government, right? We imagine that we live in a democracy, but as we can see in Detroit right now, that's just not the case. And when the state and the emergency manager make decisions, there's no accountability. There's no recourse for the citizens to fight back. And I think that's why we see these teachers taking sick outs as a measure that they actually are speaking back to what's happening in between gubernatorial elections.
Okay, this is sensitive, but let me ask you this. Where was the accountability when there was a local school board and these terrible deficits were being accumulated? Where was the accountability when the democracy, when the control was in local hands?
Yeah. I mean, I'm more familiar with the situation in Chicago, and we've had an appointed school board for decades. So the school board is essentially an arm of the mayor. So there still really is no representation in that regard.
Jeff in Detroit. Jeff, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I bought it to the Detroit schools back in the 60s, and where I graduated from are a world apart of what they are today. And I'm quite disgusted. And it's in large part because we always had private schools and public schools. I went to both. I got asked to leave one and went to the other.
Okay.
The public schools are the object of the citizenry. And the only profit that should be dictated for the public schools is the education of the children. The charter schools, which is the new word they're using in Michigan, or newer, is a bunch of free enterprise people trying to get into this, and they're taking the tax dollars that are supposed to be going to build the education, and that's part of their profit margin first, rather than the education of the kids first.
Yeah, but what about the people who helped push those in, who said the public schools just aren't doing it, we don't have any leverage because of the unions there, we have to have some alternative? You remember George W. Bush talking about the soft bigotry of low expectations and a way out.
And he's a sloganeer. They've all been doing sloganeers about this. They need to concentrate on public education. Now, you're talking about Chicago versus the state of Illinois.
Yes.
Chicago is a lot like Detroit in that most of the schools in the city proper are from the 20s and 30s, and I don't mean what we're coming into. I mean
the last ones, 1920. Yeah, it's a long history, Jeff, and we've got it. I appreciate your call very much from Detroit. Let me get one more right here, a little perspective outside this real estate, Austin, Texas. Gina is calling. Hi, Gina, you're on the air.
Hi. I think we need to stop vilifying teachers. I'm a school board member in Austin, Texas, an elected school board member.
Great.
And my experience has been that our teachers working with our parents are often who flag the issues at the campus level. We have 130 campuses in Austin, Texas. The elected leaders, the district officials, can't always know what's going on at our different campuses, and it is the teachers who are the biggest advocates for our kids and families. We are an urban district in Austin. We have a majority of our kids are economically disadvantaged, and what we have found is that the issue is poverty. And to address that, we need to provide those social services for our families so that kids can show up ready to learn. And we've done that through what we call a community schools model, where we heard from teachers at our campus level, kids were showing up hungry.
Yep.
They had there was not stability in the home. And rather than destabilize and create a whole, bring in new management, bring in new teachers, stabilized by providing much needed social services for these families. And we have turned schools around that way. This is a national model, and we, it takes money, but we pay now or we pay later.
Gina, I so appreciate your call from Austin, Texas, and right there from the heart of the school board in Austin. Elizabeth, let me bring that to you, because you're tying this up to very large issues, Black Lives Matter and more. Maybe the kind of meltdown moment we're seeing in Chicago and Detroit, and I guess it's gone on for a while, maybe that is speaking to the biggest context here, that these economies are not working, that people don't have access to good jobs, that we've got social problems and economic problems. Maybe we have to take this on in an even bigger way, but how does that happen? We've talked about that for decades.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right on with what Gina just said there, and I think it addresses exactly what you're saying. Yes, we ask schools to do so much more than in some ways they're really capable of doing, but when we acknowledge the fact that poverty is a major problem, which is something, again, that the social movement, unionism in Chicago with the Chicago Teachers Union has been pressing, right? And you insert social services, you make schools truly community schools, you can work with the students and the families and teachers. And imagine what would it look like if we reoriented our schools and had teachers and students and parents as the experts, right? And I think that's exactly what Gina was saying there. And I think, as she said, the community schools model is a national model that has shown success, but it requires investment. And we're making investments, but we're making choices about what we're investing in. And I think exactly what she said is right. If we're really serious about investing in our future, that's what we invest in.
Michelle in Detroit. Michelle, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Gina is absolutely right. My sister just recently retired from teaching 42 years. She taught about 15 years in inner city schools and then the rest of her career in not an upscale suburban community.
Okay.
But you can spend all the money you want to on Detroit schools. I'm 54 years old. I have friends who went to Detroit schools. They're engineers, doctors, lawyers, professors. And something happened in Detroit, and the community lost track that the children are our future. And we have parents that can't put food on the table, and they're not going to make sure that their kids can read when they're worried about putting food on the table. So we have a big elephant in the room, and no one wants to discuss it.
What is the elephant exactly? Is it that you need more money in there or something else, Michelle?
No, but, well, I mean, if you're going to invest in getting the parents educated, getting literacy programs for the parents who can't help their kids do homework, this is going to sound really radical, but how about we take kids that, you know, when you have a school that only 4% are proficient in math,
yeah.
How about we have boarding schools for these kids? Monday through Friday, they go to school. They get three square meals. They're in bed by 8, 9 o'clock. They're doing their homework, and then they go home on the weekends and be with their families.
Michelle, I appreciate your call as well. Andrew Rotherham, Michelle wants to get radical here. She sees a whole big envelope of problems around the schools, and you can hear her sort of uncertain whether we've got the right approaches, even when we're working hard to address them. Do we need to somehow, you know, get more radical about addressing these problems?
Yeah, I mean, look, and like public boarding schools, they do exist. There's a public boarding school in Washington, D.C. that's been operating successfully for more than a decade.
But that sounds kind of like what we did with Native Americans, you know, 150 years ago, and then everyone was ashamed later.
Absolutely, and I think we need to be careful of that. And that's why I think the key variable here has to be choice. I'm very leery of all these various ideas to tell parents what they ought to do. We ought to be offering them more choices, letting them choose. And part of the dynamic here is, you know, You may like charter schools, you may not, but parents are choosing them, and they're choosing them in large numbers. As I said, almost 15% now in Chicago, 55% in Detroit. And the numbers are the numbers. And I do think one thing that's radical, and again, reasonable people can disagree, but like the actual data, and there's a center at Stanford called Credo that evaluates charter schools nationally as sort of considered the gold standard for these. The charter schools in Detroit, on average, are delivering the equivalent of 65 extra days of learning a year for kids in math, 50 extra days in reading. And in a city like Detroit that's been so underserved for so long, that is radical. It's not the only solution. It's not the only thing we need here. And charters are not going to be the only path for Detroit, but we shouldn't. There are, even in these places with these struggles, there are things that work. And poverty matters. We have to engage with that. We have to engage with the larger systemic things that are happening to kids in these communities. But despite that, we do see things that work, and we need to be willing to, I think everybody needs to be willing to suspend disbelief on what does or does not work and all their ideological priors and try a bunch of different things. But most importantly, let parents make choices in a system like that, not coerce them into one thing or another.
Boy, meanwhile, these children's lives, their youths, are ticking by when they need to be educated. Calloway in Nashville, Tennessee. Calloway, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I just had a quick thing that I wanted to point out. You mentioned the throwdown in Chicago with the teachers union about 4.5 years ago.
Yeah.
And if I recall, the teachers union ended up getting what they asked for, right, because Rahm Emanuel caved. And then about 6 months later, several schools closed. So despite the teachers getting what they wanted, the children were the ones that lost out anyway. So what's to say that they're actually doing, you know, the union is doing what they should be doing?
Yeah, fair. Elizabeth, what do you say?
Yeah, I think part of this, again, has to go back to the way that unions have been debilitated by the law. So there are very, very narrow things that unions in Chicago are actually able to bargain for. And many of the issues that they brought up that had to do with things like creating community schools, creating supports for students, social service supports, improving the facilities of buildings, were all things that were outside of what they're actually legally allowed to bargain for.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are limited in that way. And I think that's why this shift to understanding these issues as part of a broader social movement, which is what I think we see happening in Chicago and I think we see happening in Detroit, that's understanding that teachers are activists as well, are advocating on behalf of students within and outside of the union, is something that's a really important development. And I do think that we need to understand, with this idea of choice, that people are making these choices on a very unequal playing field. There's not some menu of choices that are equally good and available to all that people are then able to choose from. And finally, the point earlier, I should say I'm very against boarding schools. I think we actually need to work with families and embed students in their families and see families as providing value added for students, not as deficits for students. And I think if we do that, then we can also look at what do parents need. I mean, if parents had jobs, right? I mean, we talk about poverty, but poverty isn't just making sure that people have food stamps, which we're cutting right now, right? But it also means creating living wage jobs for parents. And imagine how that might provide some stability to help them improve their children's education and actually have time and space to advocate.
But, you know,
because
I think,
as one of the callers said earlier, it's very difficult to advocate and go to meetings and do things on behalf of your students when you're just trying to survive.
It seems to me a lot of the talk around this has been premised on a notion that's just too much for us to take on, the whole economic, the whole picture there. So let's educate the kids so the next generation can do better. You're kind of saying, no, you can't just do that. You can't just educate the next generation out of the difficulty.
No, Tom, I don't think that's right. I think what you're setting up is a straw man. What a lot of people say, and I think you hear it in this conversation, is I'm support what Elizabeth is saying. I want to see jobs. I want to see better health care. The environmental conditions in these schools and these communities are deplorable. We need to fix them. There's probably like not a dime's bit of difference between her and I on those questions. The issue is one of pragmatism. And what I'm not prepared to do is say, let's take the pressure off of improving the schools. Because as you said, these kids are moving through now. They're only going to be in fourth grade
every
once.
Every day.
To take the pressure off of that, why we say, let's have large social campaigns and do all these other things. And I'm not saying this is Elizabeth, but frankly, there are plenty of people out there who are cynical enough. They're happy to have all those conversations rather than have the hard conversations that are really disruptive for adults about what do we do to improve the schools now. It's not an either or, but there is an element of pragmatism and sequencing, and we cannot wait for all these things to happen to step up and try to do better for these kids now. And I mean, what you're seeing play out in both of these states and cities, as we've talked about, is a whole bunch of adult politics on all sides about what the world should look like, rather than a conversation about what do we do structurally to repair these schools so that they can serve kids better right now in 2016.
I don't know about you. Use this phrase, adult politics. It's politics, and it surrounds what's going on here. Elizabeth, where do you see this fight going over whether or not the state takes over Chicago's public schools? Who's got the leverage to win that battle?
I think right now, to Andrew's point, I don't think it's an either or. These things have to happen at the same time. And I think it's hard to say to someone who's been unemployed chronically and continues to get laid off from service sector jobs that that is a less pressing concern than, you know, the quality of education. These are parallel tracks that have to be fought for at the same time. And I think that's what you see happening. And I think that's what you see happening in Chicago right now, in connections that are being made between the conditions in schools, between police brutality and state violence, between a lack of mental health clinics and services for families. And the knitting of these things together is where we're going to see change happen. And change is happening already. And we see that with the Black Lives Matter movement and the small gains that they've already been able to make. And I think we're going to continue to see this and see education being a central part of it.
Well, we will see. Watch the Supreme Court as they decide on this public unions case, which would really mark a shift in the power dynamics of public education, of course, depending how they go. Very grateful to the two of you for being with us today. Andrew Rotherham, co-founder, partner at Bellwether Education Partners in Washington, D.C. Andrew, thank you very much for pitching in today.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Todd Breland, professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Look for her book, A Political Education. Elizabeth, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.